when it's time.
Okay. Okay.
Good morning. And Happy New Year. We gather today to think about some of the things we associate with this time of year. For instance, for the last 3 weeks or so, each day provides a little more sunlight than the one before, and there's business to attend to, some of it mundane and some of it more reflective, as we bid farewell to 1 year and welcome a new one. Getting the year underway involves practical matters such as new calendars and an up-to-date modification of whatever system we use to get us to meetings and doctor's appointments. Some of us, those of a particularly anal-compulsive temperament, have already begun to pull together financial records to get a sense of where we are and to get ready for our date with the CPA. Some of us may wish to take advantage of society's willingness to look the other way if our behavior at the very moment when 2013 morphed into 2014 is best forgotten. Our primary mission this morning is remembering the lives and accomplishments of some of the people, famous and otherwise, who died this last year. But before we get to that, we will devote some formal attention to the ancient and honorable practice of making resolutions to be better people. While some say it's bad luck to share those resolutions with others, some argue that making our resolution public increases their probability of success. That brings me to remind ourselves and our guests that we welcome members and visitors without regard to their gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, income and wealth, formal education, political affiliation, age, and their stance on the issue of public versus secret New Year's resolutions. There is, I should say, some evidence that making them public increases the probability of their success. Research in journals that does say that. Finally, there will be opportunities for comments from the audience. Please use the portable microphone like this and kind of lock in whichever arm you're holding it with and your neck and face and so on. You are free to move this arm, the other arm, as much as you want, but these have to stay in place in order that your comments can be heard by people wearing the headsets and recorded by our online listeners. Brevity and civility are appreciated and often realized. There is, this is a time for some announcements. Nobody gave me any to read, so you are limited to information about coming events to this morning's bulletin, the monthly newsletter, free copies of which are available in the narthex, and at our website, uufm.net. As we light the chalice this morning, thanks to Kenneth Patton, let us honor the women and men who have cherished their hearths and gardens on this earth, our homestead. Let us give thanks to 500 generations from whom we have received our customs and our arts and our learning, our laws, and our civility. May our gratitude be known as we become one with them, and in our turn, leave benefits to the 500 generations that will follow us, to generations beyond end, if we can make peace with ourselves and all the species with whom we share this beautiful blue boat home. The opening hymn is number 38, Morning Has Broken.
Morning has broken,
first morning, blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing fresh from the word. The rains do fall, sunlit from heaven, like the first dew fall on the first grass. Praise for the sweetness of the wet garden, sprung in completeness where his feet pass. Mine is the sunlight, mine is the morning, born of the one light Eden saw play. Praise with elation, praise every morning, God's recreation of the new day.
The order of service calls for joys and concerns. I didn't think we were going to do this morning, but maybe if you have something that you would like to share for that, this would be a good time to do it. As the microphone makes its way across around the room.
Jim Chanteau. I'm sure we all appreciated the efforts of those who cleared the sidewalks and parking lot today. I'm not sure who they all were.
Dan Bush's name is the one that should be honored and for which we should give a round of applause in case he's listening to the recording.
We had a special joy at Christmas. My son-in-law, who has been unemployed for a year and a half, got a job. He's now vice president of development and alumni affairs. I don't know if you keep track of those or what, but at Illinois College, which is located in my hometown, it's unbelievable. Thank you.
Jacksonville, Illinois. Is there one back here?
Shirley.
Okay, she's right behind Mike. Let's see her. Shirley Hobrock. Just to remind everybody about the photos we're taking next Saturday and next Sunday before and after church. You'll remember to come if you're signed up. You can check the sheet out in front. If you're not signed up, please let me know. Have to come with a reservation, as we may be booked up.
Good morning. I'm Shelley Gochi from Greeley, Colorado, and I bring you greetings from Eric Banner's new church in Greeley.
Oh, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Sandy Nelson, I just wanted to say that our oldest daughter, Allison, drove across country, left yesterday morning to go to Washington, D.C., where she has an internship with the State Department. And she and Dave left yesterday at 10 a.m., just enough time to stay ahead of the storm all the way. And they made it this morning about 8 a.m., so we're happy about that.
All right, if you bring me the microphone, we'll get started with the children. Welcome to come forward, please. Okay. Well, no, I want them up here. That's fine. We're going to have a little talk about New Year's resolutions. Maybe you have seen I think it's an AT&T commercial where a man is talking to a group of children about resolutions, and one boy raises his hand and says that he wants his favorite revolution is to eat more jelly beans. And I suspect that will be an easy one to keep if his parents allow him to get close to the jelly beans. But here's what I would like to do. Why don't you all turn around to face your elders? And I gave advance notice to them, which they may or may not have taken heed of, to share, if they will, any New Year's resolutions that they have made. And we'll see as Kathleen moves around the audience to find out. Well, I'll tell you what mine is to start with, so while you're thinking about yours. I think my level of competence where the computer is concerned is about effective of 1996 or 97, something like that. And it is my commitment to raise it by 8 or 10 years. I don't think I can get to the present, but I'll go as far as I can. All right.
You are the witness. Okay. Oh, Matt's got one. All right.
To try to be more patient.
Hi, I'm Jane Pelletier. My New Year's resolution is to be more conscious of presence, whether I'm with myself or with others.
I'm Tom Phillips, and you said if we make it publicly, it's more likely to stick. Okay, there's research on that. All right, so a resolution is where you decide that something's going to happen, so be it resolved, and there's a theme here now. I'm going to try to be a nicer person this year in everything I do.
I would also like to work on patience and also try to really make an effort to be supportive in every way to those closest to me.
Well, as soon as I get my Christmas card sent out, I'm going to try to make some resolutions.
Well, my resolution is to try and keep the past resolutions that I've made in previous years, if I can remember them.
Perhaps anybody have an idea for a resolution that a child might make to good effect? If you knew of a child who might have a resolution that, okay, we've got some here. Listen, pay attention.
To ask for candy less often.
To make their bed.
To huff less often when asked to do something.
To be grateful for all that you have already.
Tough ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
Here we go.
Be kind to all the kids in your class.
Read more.
To continue being the perfect children and child that you are.
I'll try to be at least half as nice as Tom and more tolerant of my oldest sister, which is my challenge.
Take them chilling.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll come out there. You can stay here. Okay, any of you who have made or want to make public something that will that you could do during the year that might make things better for yourself or for other people, any ideas besides eat more jelly beans? All right, there's one.
Make my dad remember a little more by writing notes.
Okay, what have you got?
TNT.
What?
TNT.
I don't either. I don't think I want to go with that one. Anybody else? Anybody else got a revolution for the year? Well, in that case, I guess you're just already perfect. I mean, that's what's been said here. All right. Well, have a happy new year and have a good time where you're off to. Let hearts go with you. Go enjoy and so too. Learn and love and grow in wisdom. Show your light in all you do. Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy and glow, so too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. As many of you already know, one of my less antisocial addictions is reading obituaries. I don't read all of the hundreds of them that annually appear in the Manhattan Mercury. My stomach can handle just so much. Usually, I'm looking for information about possible connections to someone I know, as well as funeral times, and in some cases, the organization to receive memorial contributions. The 1,000 or so that appear each year in the New York Times are quite another matter. I look at every headline and read 10 to 15% of them, often skipping the most famous ones. Along the way, I find people with whom I have some connection. Specifically, I'm drawn to economists, musicians, and to those who have taken controversial, brave stands on political, religious, and social issues. The first economist on my list for last year is James Buchanan. In 1961, I read his Public Principles and the Public Debt, or Public Principles of Public Debt. Thus began a lifelong fascination, first with public debt and then with private debt as well. I spent much of my professional career trying to make sense of the role debt and lending play in our lives as individuals, and when aggregated, how they influence and are affected by the total economy. Especially intriguing to me has been trying to understand what private and public debt have in common and where analogies between the two are inappropriate. My other economist, Lawrence Klein, made his mark first as World War II was ending, while the overwhelming majority of academic and business economists confidently predicted a fall back into deep recession once huge government spending on the war ended and several million armed forces members returned to the labor market. But Klein disagreed. Based on techniques that were pretty sophisticated for the time, Klein was one of a very small group of economists who recognized that consumption deferred by 15 years of depression and war would produce huge deferred consumer demand for cars, housing, baby cribs, tricycles, and in turn would stimulate business demand for workers to produce all the stuff. He turned out to be right. It is mystifying to me that large numbers of prominent economists, some of them Nobel laureates, seem unwilling to appreciate Klein's historically based insights into the key role of aggregate demand in understanding how the economy works and what history has told us we should have been doing for the past 5 years to promote recovery from the Great Recession. Of the many musicians' obituaries I read, two stand out. The Times wrote this about Jim Hall. He was a jazz guitarist who for more than 50 years was admired by critics, aficionados, and especially his fellow musicians for his impeccable taste, technique, and warmth and subtlety of his playing. After several hours with his videos on YouTube, I can only say that the praise is understated. How I could have missed such a master guitarist during his lifetime is a mystery to me. The other musician on my list was Polish composer Wojciech Kilar. Kilar may be best known by most who know his name at all for the dozens of films for which he produced composed the music. Two of the most famous of them are Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula and Roman Polanski's The Pianist. To get a flavor of his serious music, I suggest starting with the first movement of his Piano Concerto No. 1. Its haunting simplicity carries over into the other two movements, just simply magnificent. Finally, I turn to two of my newest heroes. The headline over Murray Marder's obituary reads simply, "Early McCarthy skeptic dies at 93. For 40 years, Marder's work habits gave Washington Post editors ulcers and gray hair. But, quote, he embodied the role of public watchdog, becoming an emblem of meticulous, thorough news gathering when his persistence in laying bare the lies of Joseph R. McCarthy's anti-communist crusade helped bring Senator McCarthy to ruin. All of us owe him big time. The other new member of my pantheon of heroes is Merrill Williams, Jr., paralegal who bared big tobacco. He leaked mountains of internal documents of the Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company in 1994, fueling lawsuits that resulted in an industry payout estimated at $246 billion for damages for smoking-related losses in 46 states, including Kansas. By all accounts, Williams was no saint, but only an insider could have accomplished the triumph over big tobacco. So in closing, my advice is to read more obituaries in the coming year. The lives portrayed there provide some hope that our species might just possibly be worth trying to save. The next part of our morning will be devoted to a few minutes of quietly remembering people who died in the past year by stating the person's name and, if you wish, briefly mentioning your connection to the deceased. And as Kathleen looks around for people who want to say something, I'll tell you mine. And Doug Trudeau, who laid down the model for what kind of a colleague to be.
Well, I'll go first since we have no one just jumping on this. My dad died on January 10th. His name is Richard Simmons. And while not a perfect man or a perfect father, he gave me a lot, and he loved us all very much, and we miss him.
Fumio Matsumura, my mentor who got me a really good start in life, professional life.
Ann Marchin, and my dad died on January 3rd this past year. And, you know, I just try to think of all the different ways he tried to be an exemplary person and was very successful in a lot of ways, and I will always miss him.
Jean Ernst, who was a real good friend of mine.
My cousin Faye, she died on New Year's night, and she only lasted 6 days.
My mother, who died June 4th at age 105 and a half, and she was an exceptional community and church musician.
Sorry, I'm already verklempt. my sister died on August 4th of this year.
Pat Embers, my friend and mentor, Judy Metcalf, died on November 7th.
Hi, one of my best friends from the third grade. We've known each other since the third grade, and she fought breast cancer for over 20 years. And they told her over 20 years ago she had 6 months to live, so what a fighter she was, and I could always call her anytime. So I miss Ruth, my friend Ruth Marcy.
Well, I'm reminded actually of two. This is Tom Phillips. Dick reminded me that my mentor from University of Wisconsin, Wendell Burkholder, died on or about the same day as Fumio. And I had the pleasure to meet Fumio when I first went there, but Wendell influenced my life greatly. The second person who influenced my life was my Uncle Bobby, the youngest of my mother's siblings, died early in 2013. And he just was a great guy. I always remembered him because he was a salesman. And when he would travel through Harrisburg, where we lived, he would drop off and see my mom and give me some jeans or some slacks or something because he was selling men's clothes to department stores. So it's great memories.
Gene Severs. Gene Ernst, who was a founding member and very active and critical member of our Columbian artist group, and Alan Yonke. First got to know him playing volleyball on a Sunday evening, rural Wyona community games where once a young man reached high school age, he could participate with the mostly farmer dads in the community.
My friend Lynn Stitz, who was a bridge player and a friend of mine at Bridge for 30-some years, she is greatly missed.
Jean Ernst, who has been mentioned before, was a colleague of Burns in the College of Architecture, Planning, and Design. He was an architect, a painter, a delineator, a really wonderful friend. We'll miss him.
I'm Dick Cattell. I'm put in mind of my office mate of about 30 to 40 years and close friend that drove to work every day for a good many years as well. And he was a very outspoken person, which was a good example to me. I had lots of room to follow that example.
A friend of mine from high school named Sarah took her own life on New Year's Eve.
Judy Cattell, we just wanted to remember this grandson of a very, very good friend of ours from Colorado who died on New Year's Eve in an avalanche skiing. In Colorado.
Ken Embers, I wanted to say something else about Gene Ernst. He helped us design our house, do a remodel, and we were being very conservative and trying to think what little things we could do to gain more space and how it could be more accommodating. And we asked Gene for suggestions. He says, you know, you can do anything you want to do. And that was a great inspiration.
And might just remember Jean Davis, too. She wasn't really a member here, but certainly came here a lot last year and participated in programs at Meadowlark while she could.
Thanks to all. The offertory, the piece we'll listen to is from Andrew Lloyd Webber's Requiem Pia Jesu, sung by Anna Netrebko and the boy soprano Andrew Swaite, the Prague Philharmonic Chorus and Orchestra accompany as the Dead Baskets. Our program is Losses in the Human Family for this last year. Sarah Hoyt begins.
I'm going to be talking about Doris Lessing this morning. And just do my library duty and cite my sources. This piece pulls heavily from the New York Times piece written by Helen T. Vorongos that came out when Doris Lessing died on November 17th of this past year. But no matter how well-read I think I am, I constantly find another blind spot, another author, or horrors, an entire group of authors about whom I know very little at all. When Doris Lessing died this past year, I trawled through the flotsam of my reading life for memories of her works, and I retrieved very little. I was so embarrassed. I thought, well, I think there was that short story in an anthology I taught, an intro to lit students while I was a TA at KU. And in it, a white couple in South Africa have a small boy and are desperate to protect themselves from the outside world, so they post signs and equip the wall around their home with iron gates and glass and razor wire. And then one night, the young boy disappears, and they discovered he'd climbed the gardener's ladder to scale the wall of the compound, and you can imagine the rest. So I thought I knew the direction I would take while talking to you today. I would speak of Doris Lessing's commitment to social justice, particularly ending apartheid. And then I began my research and found that, no, this Doris Lessing story was actually written by Nadine Gordimer, who is one of our contemporaries, and with whom she had a lot in common regarding their commitment to social justice. But it meant that I had even less knowledge of Doris Lessing than I did when I started. So I did discover that Doris Lessing was a more complex, enigmatic figure than I could have imagined. She has been called the epicist of the female experience, who with skepticism, fire, and visionary power has subjected a divided civilization to scrutiny. And more simply, it has been said that she personified the woman's role in the 20th century. That's stating quite a lot. In her works, Lessing examined and questioned relationships between men and women, social inequities, and racial divisions. So, in brief, Lessing by the numbers, born October 22, 1919, in present-day Iran, the first child of Alfred Cook Taylor, a British bank official and World War I veteran, and the former Emily Maud McVeigh, his wartime nurse. They later moved to southern Rhodesia, present-day Zimbabwe, where she grew up. Her formal education ended at 14. She went on to have three children, two marriages, two divorces, and many, many lovers. She wrote dozens upon dozens of books, ranging from novels and short story collections to plays. She wrote autobiography, postmodern fiction, science fiction, for which she was often derided by those in the literary community, nonfiction about everything from Africa to cats, and even an opera in collaboration with Philip Glass. She won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2009, and she died in London on November 17th, 2013, after 94 years spent on three different continents. More specifically, what will be remembered of her legacy? In that New York Times article, the author, Vorongos, writes that the Golden Notebook, which critics generally consider her best novel, has been published in many languages and is still in print 50 years after it first appeared. It consists, if you can imagine this, of a conventional novel called Free Women and several notebooks, each in a different color, kept by the protagonist, Anna Wolfe, a novelist struggling with writer's block. Vrongos explains, the Black Notebook deals with Africa and the novel Anna wrote from her experiences there. The Red Notebook chronicles her Communist Party days, which was a very strong influence in Lessing's life. The Yellow is an autobiographical novel within the larger novel, and the Blue is a diary of sorts. And so then the Golden Notebook at the end, that's the title of the book, right, brings together ideas and thoughts from other sections. In 1962, this book was daring for its frank exploration of the inner lives of women who, unencumbered by marriage, were free to raise children or not and pursue work and their sex lives as they chose. Lessing did not like that her book was seen as a feminist work, and even though her novels and stories were filled with the issues at the core of the feminist movement, she never minced words when critiquing elements of the movement she disagreed with. And this is one of the most traditionally contradictory and frustrating things for me in contemplating Doris Lessing's life. Vrongos writes that some ideas embraced by the women's movement came naturally to her, but she absolutely rejected others, such as sexual harassment. She thought women were just being too sensitive. And so while these opinions are surprising to me, it is her life choices that I find so extraordinary, so ambitious and driven to jettison traditional roles as wife and mother in South Rhodesia. She left her two oldest children entirely to engage fully with her ideals and life with her friends and communist comrades. Vrongo says she moved out of the family home to a rented room, took a job as a typist, and kept up with news of her children through a relative. This drastic step was accorded no more than a few pages in her autobiography, and she dwelled on neither her reasons nor her regrets at any length in interviews. I couldn't stand that life, she said in an interview with Salon. It's this business of giving all the time, day and night, trying to conform to something you hate. This also dovetails with Vorongos writes about Lessing's relationship with her own mother. She was greatly resentful toward her mother, who never let her forget how much she had sacrificed for her children. In a review of her first autobiography in the New York Times, one critic said, Miss Lessing's matter-of-fact tone in writing about the period in which she left her children gives a vivid, if somewhat chilling, picture of the author as a self-absorbed and heedless young woman. So, Doris Lessing pursued her own interests, desires, professional, political, and sexual. She was unafraid of what others thought. Oh, Christ, she said upon hearing that she'd won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2007, adding, I couldn't care less. Upon her death, NPR noted that Lessing once refused to allow the Queen to declare her a dame of the British Empire because, in the author's words, there is no British Empire. Clearly, in reading about Doris Lessing, then, I was able to reflect on many themes: ambition, rejection of traditional women's roles, and conviction to political causes. I came away in awe of her accomplishments, and also certain that I did not aspire to be like her in many ways. I did check out the Golden Notebook, intending to read it, but my brain and sense of intellectual curiosity took a holiday over the winter break, and I barely cracked the spine. My brain, addled with sugar and cross-country flights, churlishly rejected the work as a postmodern mess. This is ridiculous, of course, although it's true, as Vorongos writes, that Lessing wrote long, dense, and complex novels. Her prose, one critic described as indigestible. And J.M. Cutsey wrote that Lessing has never been a great stylist. She writes too fast and prunes too lightly for that. So if I had finished one of her books, I thought, as I read that assessment, I could decide for myself. And then, last night, while combing through websites about Lessing's life again, I came across a summary of Ben in the World, which was published in 2000. Wait, I thought, I have read that. Ben, an 18-year-old British man, was the fifth child in his happy family, but born a physical anomaly, a monster, feral. He eats raw meat, feels intense, violent rages. And so this lonely outsider leaves his family, and a series of misadventures takes him to Brazil, where he meets a tribe like him, a group akin to prehistoric man. And so maybe what I will take from my reflections on Doris Lessing is this. We are all wanderers, all strange, all making decisions that may seem incomprehensible to others, but all seeking our tribe.
Well, I considered coming in costume this morning as an American homesteader, partly in remembrance of my mother, who was the daughter of homesteaders, and my own early life, which was marked by no electricity, no running water, et cetera, et cetera. And this morning, it sort of felt like a winter morning on the farm when we put on enormous amounts of clothing and went outside to take care of the animals. In fact, I was dressed like that this morning, going out to engage the snowblower with electric start and self-propelled. And I actually had Shirley's permission to come this morning as a homesteader, but I thought better of it and said, oh, what the heck. But this relates to my topic, in fact, believe it or not, of Andrew Linklater's remembrance, because, as you will see, he had more to say about American frontierism than anyone else. I think it's very relevant to today, and you'll see what I mean. Andrew Linklater was a Scot born in Edinburgh, and who died November 3rd in Edinburgh at the age of 68. He was a lowland Scot, a historian, and like his countryman John Muir, although of a different generation, has done a lot to further America's understanding of itself and the past compared to the long list of other pretenders, historians who have written about the settlement of the American continent. Two of his books are particularly relevant. Measuring America, How an Untamed Wilderness Shaped the United States and Fulfilled the Promise of Democracy, written in 2002. And the second one, The Fabric of America, How Our Borders and Boundaries Shaped the Country and Forged Our National Identity, written in 2007. Clearly, order had to be maintained for the floods of immigrants arriving from the 17th to the 20th century. Otherwise, they would have been mired in chaos and disputes over property ownership, the general point of measuring America, if you can take that and remember that. Linklater argues that the relentless human tendency to move on to new unexplored places is not an exclusively American ideal. The whole world was in flux during the period of immigration that marks settlement of the American continent. People were moving east as well as west. The whole world was in ferment at the time. His thesis is that there are lessons to be learned about the current population movements worldwide, where people are seeking to find a better life in a different land. However, Linklater alters some of the myths that we have about our own rugged American frontier past. Namely, the idea that we have that rugged individualism is assumed to be the essence of the American character. He shows how immigrants and pioneers surging west to occupy new land were generally reassured, however, by government promises of land ownership and a system of protection for individual property rights. Pioneers depended greatly on the security that they derived from government protection of land rights. Extended family and community groups would never have plunged into the wilderness without a destination and the reassurance that their rights would have been protected. These intrepid settlers, quoting Licklider, knew that their desire to own the land was backed by the Constitution and the entire panoply of law. Every new wave of settler had a vested interest in introducing government and law and order as quickly as possible so that their claims could be recognized. Surely there were individuals who moved into the frontier, either newly arrived, restless, or needing new land after two or three generations of divisions of family land. The landscape was dotted with crude cabins and abandoned homesteads as they depleted the land and moved further westward. Sometimes when neighbors got too close, that was sufficient to cause them to move. Even then, the government took care of them. The Preemption Act of 1830, for example, protected the rights of those individuals who squatted without any benefit of a land survey. We have a popular image today of America's pioneers as libertarian individualists who broke the confines of the governed world to find freedom in an ungoverned frontier. Today's libertarians bluster about returning to the past when government did not interfere with individual rights. Linklater's work shows how this utopian image is largely a myth. He helps us to reimagine the ancestral American national character. In his first presidential address to Congress in 1790, George Washington put the establishment of a survey of government lands as almost as important as establishing the provision for the national defense and a common currency. A shrewd businessman, Washington established the Public Land Survey as a means by which the enormous debts of the Revolution could be paid for. By surveying and subdividing the wilderness into lots for sale, the government established a legal framework for property ownership and guaranteed protection of settlers' rights, whether contested with others or by American Indian tribes from which virtually all of the land had been seized. At the time, the good sense of our founding fathers seemed to lean on a decimal system. However, land measurement systems in use in England at the time worked against them, most notably the system that revolutionized land ownership in Great Britain. Gunter's chain, most notably, which was already in use in America when the survey began in 1784 on the Ohio frontier, everything west of the Appalachian Mountains. Linklater's book, The Fabric of America, maintains that the conquest of America owed more to the surveyor's chain than to the Conestoga wagon or the repeating rifle. One may be more familiar with the rod as a system of land measurement. However, Gunter's chain, a 22-yard chain that could be rolled up and put in your pocket, much more easier to transport than a 16-foot rod, became the practical surveyor's standard in British America after 1607. There is a place near Liverpool, Ohio, that is regarded as the point at which the United States began to take physical shape. It is known as the Point of Beginning. It is an actual point on the ground, which is the starting point for the grid, which was laid out by the land survey to apply to all the rest of America over the next few centuries. North to Canada, west to the Pacific Ocean, and south to Mexico. This 3 million square mile grid created a structure of land ownership unique in history, the web supporting the legend of the frontier with covered wagons and cowboys, farmers and gold miners. It affects every American who has ever owned a square yard of soil on this continent. Immigrants to America came with a desire for freedom, leaving behind the rigid social structures of Europe and the system of feudalism and its land ownership and succession practices that governed Europe for 1,000 years.
America offered land and the right to own and use it for one's own fortunes, a love of private property with boundary lines and government, an enforcement of property rights by that government shaped the American character more than anything from the authority-wary lone wolf concept that has arisen in recent times. Andrew Linklater was born in Edinburgh in 1944. He studied at Oxford, but was not drawn to the academic life, and he became an independent historian. In late October, while researching a book about mass starvation in the Hebrides during the 19th century, when English landowners forcibly removed Scots from large areas of the chain of islands off the coast of Scotland to make room for sheep farming, Mr. Linklater had a heart attack on the island of Eigg. He died a week later in Edinburgh Hospital. He said, finally, in an interview, "It is too easy to imagine that the United States was always destined for greatness. There were many, many paths, however, that it might have taken that would lead to an entirely different evolution if we had not begun to measure America." Thank you.
As a woman, a journalist, and someone who just enjoys getting informative and insightful news, I have much to thank Helen Thomas for. Thomas was a wire service correspondent and columnist whose sharp questions from the front row of the White House press room challenged and annoyed 10 presidents. She was effective in divulging information that federal officials would have preferred to have kept secret. Thomas died July 20th, 2013, at the age of 92. And I feel fortunate that during my time in D.C., I was able to meet her at a few occasions. Helen Thomas was born August 4, 1920, in Winchester, Kentucky, one of 9 children of immigrants from present-day Lebanon. A few years after her birth, the family moved to Detroit, where her father ran a grocery store. And they lived in a diverse neighborhood that was home to people of Italian, African, German, and Arab ancestry. She found her career while working on her high school newspaper. She then studied journalism at what is now Wayne State University in Detroit. After graduating in 1942, she moved to Washington, D.C., where she briefly worked as a copy girl, which is basically a gopher, at the old Washington Daily News. In 1943, United Press Wire Service hired her to write radio scripts for a salary of $24 a week. In 1960, Thomas was assigned to cover the presidential campaign of John F. Kennedy. When Kennedy won, UPI assigned her to cover the White House. She covered all the presidents from Kennedy in 1961 to Obama in 2010 when she retired. Thomas was known for always asking the hard questions and working hard, long hours to uncover the news. She arrived at work every morning before dawn and accompanied presidents on overseas trips. She was the only female print reporter to accompany Nixon on his historic visit to China. And later, when she was in her 70s and 80s, she often outdistanced younger reporters on arduous around-the-world travels. Thomas spent much of her life fighting against what she considered unearned privilege, leading a decades-long battle to gain female reporters equal access to jobs, news, and newsmakers. In the 1950s and 60s, Thomas and a couple other female reporters fought to gain admittance to the newsmaking luncheons at the National Press Club, which then barred women from its membership. The club, with the help of the U.S. State Department, booked world leaders to come and speak, and women, even those who worked for prominent press outlets, were not allowed to attend. The lobbying finally paid off after a planned appearance of Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev was nearly canceled. Women were allowed, starting in 1956, but were relegated to the balcony, and they were not allowed to ask questions. Women were finally allowed to join the National Press Club as full members in 1971. Thomas became the club's first female officer, as well as the first woman to be named White House Bureau Chief of a major wire service, the first woman to be admitted to the Gridiron Club, which is a journalism group, and the first woman to serve as president of the White House Correspondents Association, and the recipient of multiple Lifetime Achievement Awards. And it wasn't until I was researching her that I realized that I benefited from her work as well, because I attended many National Press Club events where I was able to go as a journalist. Thomas was well known for her tough questions, and she firmly believed that it was the media's duty to hold elected officials accountable. Thomas was especially critical of George W. Bush, calling him the worst president in American history, a comment which caused him to freeze her out by not calling on her at press conferences for a full 3 years. Thomas publicly criticized her colleagues in the press for failing to ask the hard questions of the Bush administration. Quote, "I respect the office of the presidency," she said, "but I never worship at the shrines of our public servants. They owe us the truth. We, the media, are the only institution in our society that can question a president on a regular basis and make him accountable. Otherwise, he would be queen. He would be king, excuse me. Freudian slip." Unquote. Presidents knew to expect tough questions from Thomas, but they soon learned her quick wit would bite them as well. When a set of fortune-telling scales once spewed out a card for Gerald Ford, saying, quote, "You're a brilliant leader," she glanced at the card and cracked, quote, "You got your weight wrong, too." In China, she accompanied Pat Nixon to a farm where the First Lady wondered about the breed of some pigs in a pen. "Male chauvinist, of course," she quipped. And when a man told her that ladies were not allowed at a Bible study class taught by Jimmy Carter, she retorted, "I'm no lady, I'm a reporter." Her performances at the annual Gridiron Club song and dance show often brought down the house. She appeared in comedian Stephen Colbert's mock audition tape in 2006 for the job of president spokesman, playing herself in relentless pursuit of him. And she turned up in President Clinton's 2000 spoof tape as well. After spending most of her working life at UP, United Press, Thomas quit the wire service in 2000, the day after the announcement that it had been bought by News World Communications, a company founded and controlled by the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, leader of the Unification Church. With her fellow journalists applauded her conviction and her bravery. Within 2 months, she became a columnist for Hearst newspaper and resumed her seat in the White House briefing room. Up until that point, she had earned the front row seat, and she often got to ask the first question of the press conference. And when she quit UPI, she lost her seat. And when she was hired back by Hearst, she was admitted back into the press room, but she was relegated to the back seat. But that didn't last for too long because her fellow colleagues in the White House press corps pushed for her to get her seat in the front again. Her hallowed career, however, came to an end under a cloud of controversy. In 2010, a YouTube video surfaced showing her saying that Israel should, quote, "get the hell out of Palestine," and that Jewish people should go home to Poland, Germany, America, and everywhere else. Thomas apologized for her remarks, stating they did not reflect, quote, "they do not reflect my heartfelt belief that peace will come to the Middle East only when all parties recognize the need for mutual respect and tolerance. May that day come soon." However, the damage had already been done. And she announced her retirement 1 week later, at the age of 90. The journalism field and the world in general will miss Helen Thomas. We need more people like her who ask the tough questions, even if it means stepping on some toes.
Christian de Duve had a long, rich life and a healthy and productive old age. His contributions were profound and lasting. His mind and wit were clear and sharp right up to the end. He died last May at the age of 95, and he died as he had lived, with intention, by committing legal-assisted suicide in his home country of Belgium. He had cancer, atrial fibrillation, had recently had a bad fall. He wasn't depressed. He was just strategic. He'd already lived long and well. He saw the inevitable decline that lay ahead. He didn't want to be a burden on his family or to be at the mercy of others. De Duve, who was a non-believer, said, "I do not claim to be unafraid of death, but I do not fear what comes after death." Christian de Duve was a scientist. He was a biochemist and cell biologist. His great contribution to science involved his discoveries about the compartmentalization of functions inside the cell. The cell is the basic unit of life, the simplest living thing, of which all complex life is composed. Your body, for example, is just a neat way to package 30 trillion cells. De Duve discovered that many basic life functions of cells occur in specialized compartments inside the cell, specialized little mini cells within the cell, where the important day-to-day business of life gets done. To be specific for you biologists out there, he discovered the existence of lysosomes and peroxisomes. Lysosomes are the combined stomach and recycling bin of the cell, also doing coast guard duty on the side where nutrients are digested, foreign viruses and bacteria are collected and destroyed, and where cell wastes are recycled. And peroxisomes are little biochemical reactors where oxygen, fats, and cholesterol are utilized and metabolized. Deduve's work opened new vistas in understanding the inner workings of the cell. In addition to being a brilliant scientist, he was also a man of great humility, which is why I got interested in reading about him. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine 40 years ago, but it didn't go to his head, even after so many decades of living with this exalted status conferred by that honor. While he was extremely gratified and happy to be honored with a Nobel Prize, he understood the element of luck in the Nobel Committee selections or in any selection process. And he knew that for every Nobel Prize awardee or any type of awardee, there were more than a few others equally deserving of the honor who weren't so recognized. He called the Nobel selection process a lottery with a very high ticket price. Yes, you do have to prepare and accomplish much to be in contention, but after that, it's just a throw of the dice. If I had not made these discoveries, he said, others would have. I do not expect to be remembered. I'm grateful to have had the opportunity to be a participant in the great human endeavor of scientific discovery and to have made some small contributions to scientific knowledge. That is sufficient, unquote. Deduve frequently spoke about his views on creativity and on mentoring. He said, quote, "It's extremely important to be open to the ideas of others and to give young people the freedom to develop their own ideas. The secret of creativity is elusive. It's a very complex cocktail. For a creative environment to flourish, you must first recruit the best people possible to work on a project, then create an environment in which they can develop their own potential. This environment includes the infrastructure, the tools and equipment, the colleagues, and an atmosphere in which easy interaction and freedom of thought is encouraged. Mere intelligence is not enough for great success in science. It is not false modesty for me to say that I've had colleagues who are much more intelligent than I, but they did not achieve as much in science because they lacked the most important quality that a scientist can possess, imagination. Imagination is where science and art coincide. It is a quality that is essential to great accomplishment in either realm," unquote. Some years back, the John Templeton Foundation produced a series of conversations among leading scientists and scholars about, quote, the big questions facing humankind. The big question posed in one of these conversations was, does the universe have a purpose? Christian Deduve was one of 12 scientists, philosophers, and scholars chosen to discuss this question, and his answer was, no. A purpose, he said, presupposes a mind that conceived the purpose, as well as the ability to implement it. The owner of this mind not only created the universe the way it is, but could have created other universes. For some reason, he decided against those other versions. This creator went through the very human process of pondering decisions and acting on alternatives. In a way, this is a very anthropomorphic vision of God. To defenders of the anthropic principle, what is peculiar about the universe is that it has just the right physical properties to give rise to life and through life to the human mind. But such an anthropocentric view of creation is not readily reconciled with what is known of the evolutionary origin of mankind. Jacques Monod said that nature does not have any intention or goal. Monod believed that life and mind arose by an extraordinarily unlikely combination of improbable circumstances and that man is utterly alone in an unfeeling immensity of a meaningless universe. I don't subscribe to this view. In my opinion, life and mind are such extraordinary manifestations of matter that they remain meaningful, however many universes unable to give rise to them exist or are possible. Diluting our universe with trillions of others in an endless multiverse in no way diminishes the significance of its unique properties, which I see as revealing clues to the ultimate reality that lies behind them. Science has given us a glimpse of this reality by revealing the strange objects and concepts, almost irreducible to our familiar world, that lie behind entities such as cosmos, matter, life, and mind. Through music, art, and literature, we've been allowed to approach another facet of this reality, emotional and aesthetic rather than intelligible. With philosophy and religion, we have become aware of its ethical and mystical aspects, encompassing all in a single manifestation, love, has introduced us into its very heart. It will be noted that there is no logical need for a creator in this view. And by the way, I'm still quoting him. I've been quoting him for the last few minutes. It will be noted that there is no logical need for a creator in this view. By definition, a creator must himself be uncreated. That is, he must never have been created. That is, he must always have existed, unless he is part of an endless Russian doll succession of creators within creators. But then why start the succession at all? Why not say the universe itself was uncreated, that is, has always existed, and is simply the manifestation of ultimate reality rather than the work of an uncreated creator? The question is worth asking. I hold the view that life is a likely, even an obligatory and unavoidable manifestation of matter written into the fabric of the universe, and that life, including intelligent life, must be widespread in our galaxy and in other galaxies. I see no reason to change my mind on the topic.
Think of it as more metaphorical than literal story here. Stand as you're able. I was standing by my window on one cold and cloudy day when I saw thee first come a-rolling for to carry my mother away. Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky. Lord, I told that undertaker, undertaker, please drive slow, for that body you are carrying, Lord, I hate to see her go. Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky. Oh, I follow close behind her, try to hold up and be brave, but I could not hide my sorrow when they laid her in the grave. Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a better world awaiting in the sky, Lord, in sky. I went home, Lord, my home was lonesome, missed my mother, she was gone. All my brothers, sisters crying, what a home so sad and lone. Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky. Closing words are from Khalil Gibran on death. Life and death are one, even as the river and the sea are one. Only when you drink from the river of silence shall you sing. Only when you have reached the mountain top, then you shall begin to climb. And when the earth shall claim your limbs, then shall you truly dance. So be it. Thanks.